getting enough restful sleep at night is a challenge, even when we're not in a pandemic. This hour of the morning show, we're learning how and why the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting our sleep and what we can do about it. Good morning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. According to the National Institutes of Health, anywhere between 50 and 70 million Americans have sleep or wakefulness disorders. Has your sleep been disrupted in recent weeks? What are your dreams like? What questions do you have about your sleep cycles and how to improve your rest in these difficult times? We're at email this morning. Send yours to ideas at WPR.org. That's ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Roxanne Pritchard is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, where she studies sleep and circadian rhythms. Roxanne, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, peel back the curtain for us. What is life like as a sleep researcher right now at your home?
Let's see. Not much has changed in terms of our family's sleep. I have a 10-year-old, a 4-year-old, a husband who has a sleep disorder, and myself. So I think that the biggest change is that my 10-year-old sleeps in later and goes to bed later because she doesn't have to get up for school.
But how is that working out?
I think it's fine. I mean, she's listening more to her body rhythm. She's a night owl, so she goes to bed around 10:30 and sleeps till 9 or 9:30.
And I understand there's been some tenting.
Oh, yes. So I guess the walls of our house seem kind of small at times. So the 10-year-old and then sometimes the 4-year-old expresses interest in sleeping outside in the backyard. So we put up a tent and sometimes we sleep out there, which is lovely. It's cooler. It's quieter. It's fun to think you're on a sort of vacation.
So sleep specialists are saying that due to the pandemic, there are a lot of sleep issues going on. What are you discovering right now about, you know, your profession?
Right. So there's a lot of questions this brings up. First is, obviously, this is a big stressor. It's on our minds a lot. It's making our insomnia worse. So for the people that have insomnia or anxiety, having this worldwide global crisis is making it harder to relax and fall into sleep. It also is changing the sort of the good behaviors we do that would help us get good sleep. So regular exercise is harder to come by for a lot of people now. And our coping mechanisms, it can make sleep worse. So drinking alcohol, especially kind of in the evening, isn't good for sleep. Nicotine isn't good for sleep. So some of the things we might be doing are bad for sleep. Also, it's important for us to kind of get a lot of sunshine and light during the day. And for people that live in apartments where it's not safe to go out and take a walk, it can make our sleep much worse, too.
And we're also spending a lot of time with screens, whether it's a student or someone on their job working from home and getting even the latest information.
Right. And screens can really disrupt our sleep in three different ways. One, they, especially towards bedtime, can just take up time. So you plan to go to bed, but you just need to watch one more episode of Hollywood or something, which I did. So that's time displacement. Another is emotional arousal. And this is a really big one right now. So I am equipped to check the news and read sort of scary information in the morning. I can handle it then. But I stopped with anything that could be stressful in the afternoon or evening, because otherwise I just will ruminate about it and think about it. And most of that's beyond my control. So it doesn't do me any good to read about it. So if we're reading kind of content that is scary or anxiety provoking or stress provoking, that can make it so we can't relax to fall asleep. And then the third way is just the lights from our screens, especially if you don't have a blue light filter on your phone or computer, tricks our brain into thinking we're seeing daylight. So our brain stops producing the amount of melatonin we usually do, and that makes it harder to fall asleep.
We're
those are three ways, screens can interrupt our sleep.
We're talking with Roxanne Pritchard, a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota, taking your questions about your sleep. How are you doing right now with your sleep? Are you feeling tired? What is getting in the way of trying to fall asleep or having a restful night's sleep? Join in with your questions, your observations during the pandemic at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Roxanne, how many hours of sleep should we adults be getting each night?
The official standard is 7 to 9 for adults. I probably get a little bit less than that, but spend about 7 hours in bed. So I feel like if you allow at least 7 to 9 hours of time in bed, you go to bed when you're feeling sleepy, you wake up when you feel rested, that's fine for your body. There's a new kind of disorder called orthosomnia, where we're spending so much anxiety tracking our sleep and looking at our apps and our phones and our Fitbits that tell us how much we've slept. It makes our sleep worse. So I like to follow body cues that say, you know, do I feel well-rested? A well-rested person isn't going to feel tired all day, isn't going to need to chug coffee all day. So,
there's a whole industry that's grown up around how to, you know, get a better sleep. I mean, there's so many apps and devices and things we can buy. Does it work?
I would say some things work for some people, but you probably don't need to be spending a lot of money trying to get good sleep. So there's some things I absolutely need that I'm grateful that I bought, like blackout curtains. I'm in, you know, Minnesota. The light comes at 5 in June. So I need those blackout curtains if I have any hope of sleeping past 5 in the morning. Other things I really like are kind of background noise. I live on a busy street with a fire station, so I need a little like wave sound or something. And that can be a, you know, cheap app or free app or something. So that's some of the things that I need, but I don't think we need the really expensive stuff. Some people respond well to weighted blankets. I think a little study we did at our university on student sleep found that the majority of students felt they slept better if they had a weighted blanket, especially if they were anxious or struggling with kind of anxiety. It just felt like they were more secure, but some students hated it. So yeah, a lot of this is going to be, does it work for you?
Right. And certainly the climate inside your room where you're sleeping, what you're doing in there can all factor in, I would imagine, to whether you're going to be able to get a restful night's sleep.
Absolutely. So gold standard is that your room should be like a cave, cold, dark, quiet. So for some people, that's going to take a little bit more investment to make it that way than others.
We're talking with Roxanne Pritchard, who is our guide to sleep. She's a neuroscience and psychology professor at the University of St. Thomas. Do you battle anxiety? How has your sleep been affected? And parents, how are you sleeping? What is keeping you awake at night? And how are you dealing with bouts of insomnia? Kids and teens, let's hear from you. How are you handling your sleep when school start times aren't as rigid and you're not leaving home? Share your situation, your questions about sleep at 800-642-1234. You can email them to ideas@WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Roxanne Pritchard right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about sleep disruptions during the pandemic here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Psychologists say we've lost our what are called time acres, like dropping the kids off at school or arriving at the office, going to the gym. All these things help establish routines. And if you've lost your job or you're working limited hours, You may be sleeping later or even sleeping more, which can lead to loss of focus and irritability. So how has your sleep been in the past few months? What are you doing to improve it, and how is that working? Have you had vivid dreams since the outbreak? What are they like? Share with us at 800-642-1234. Roxanne Pritchard is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of St. Thomas, and she stays with us. Roxanne, can you explain for us REM cycles, REM cycles, why we wake up at intervals during the night?
Absolutely. So sleep isn't just one thing. We cycle through different types of sleep. We can have light sleep, and that's a sleep where we're really easily aroused. It's easy to wake us up. And if you have insomnia or anxiousness, sometimes the whole night can feel like that. You're kind of going back and forth between wakefulness and fitful sleep. We have deep, deep, slow wave sleep, and that's where it's almost impossible to wake you up calling your name. So that deep, slow wave sleep is really important for human health. That's in the first half of the night, and it feels awful to be woken up from there. So sometimes if you have an alarm clock go off there, it's an inertia that lasts an hour. And then the fastest cycle during sleep is called REM, rapid eye movement sleep. It's called paradoxical sleep in French and other European countries because it's a paradox. Our brain looks like it's as active as if we were driving on the interstate in rush hour, yet we're sleeping. So it's during this REM state when our brain is extremely active, our body is mostly paralyzed, but our eyes are moving back and forth, that we have the most vivid dreams. So we spend about 2 hours a night, usually in the last half of sleep, in this REM sleep. And it can last for just a few minutes, or it can last for up to 30 minutes. But that's when you have these vivid dreams.
What is going on with these vivid dreams? Because we're hearing reports that they're pretty elaborate right now during the pandemic, that people are sharing them.
Right. And the study of dreams has always been around, right? So it's part of many people's spiritual traditions. In many of the major religious traditions, it's a way to kind of converse with higher spiritual powers is looking at this dream content. Of course, Freud was very into what we dream about. What we know about dreams, I guess, from a modern neuroscience perspective, is that they are important sort of ways to process what we are experiencing in the day. They help us figure out what we need to remember and also what we need to forget. So in some ways, dreams are a little bit of a random activation of recently experienced concepts, sensations, ideas, thoughts. But they're not very logical. And they also have a high emotional tone to them. So in our dreaming, we often dream about escape, threat, embarrassment, sex, planning, preparation. So those are a lot of the emotional tones that are added to dreams. So I've actually been taking place of a sleep study. So since the pandemic kind of began in earnest in the United States, every day I've been filling out a dream diary, a sleep diary that asks questions. And so I've been paying more attention to my dreams than I normally do.
What has happened? What have you found?
What I found is that I am I'm more aware of my dreams. And I think part of that is you have to wake up to remember what you dreamed. So if you're one of those people that's like, oh, I never dream, I never remember your dreams, that just means you're sleeping straight through the night and you're probably more rested than the rest of us. So I think we're remembering our dreams more because we're waking up more because our body is more anxious. We're more aware of a threat. And so when we're under these threats, our body makes it more like, oh, what was that? Let's wake up. Let's check it out. So that might be one reason we're more aware of our dreams.
Would you suggest that we do keep sleep diaries? Could that be another way to help improve our sleep and be more restful?
It depends. So sleep diaries, I think, make me more mindful. And actually, this makes me more mindful because this diary that I fill out asks me every day, did I exercise? How much did I exercise?
Oh, dear.
Did I have alcohol? How much did I have alcohol? So because of that, I've probably been drinking less than I normally, oh, not normally, but less than my lesser pandemic self would, and making sure I get out at least for a walk every day. Just
just to feel better about this survey thing.
Just to feel a little bit better. Socially desirable responding. But it, just kind of measuring it can help some people. Other people, it's going to make them more anxious about it. But from that, I realize I have a pretty regular sleep schedule. I go to bed with my older kid around 10-ish, 10:30-ish. We talk, we chat, say goodnight. And then I wake up around somewhere between 5:30 and 6:30-ish.
And that's pretty consistent from night to night. Like you're able to stay on a schedule.
Yep. That's like, it would be impossible for me to sleep in if I tried. I'm a strong morning person. So this is just my body's rhythm.
We're talking with Roxanne Pritchard, who studies sleep as a professor of neuroscience and psychology at University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. Taking your questions about sleep at 800-642-1234. How has it been during the pandemic? Are you noticing your dreams? Are you writing them down? Do you have any tools that you use in order to have a more restful night's sleep? We're at 800-642-1234. Jeremy from Whitewater called in, couldn't stay with us. Jeremy says they work the third shift. They sleep 6 hours during the day, and that seems to be working just fine for Jeremy. Is 6 hours of sleep enough for some people, Roxanne?
For some people, maybe 1 in 5,000 or 10,000, that's enough. The things we want to look for in sleep are the quantity. So if you're able to get that closer to 7, I think some of the research says that will be better. The consistency, so if you're on the third shift, but you have a really consistent rhythm where you don't go back to a normal schedule on your days off, but you keep the same sleep hours, that's going to be better for you. And then the third is the quality. So before my husband was treated for a sleep disorder, he could sleep 10 hours and still be exhausted. So is something interfering with your sleep quality, like a sleep disorder or a bad sleep environment? So if 6 hours is consistent and the quality is good, it's on the shorter end, but it's a lot of people do it.
Yeah. If you do work a third shift or your day is black as night and you have to be on during the night hours and sleep during the day, what do you suggest?
There's a lot of great research about shift work sleep disorder. About 1 in 5 of us can do this pretty well. And those tend to be naturally night owls. Can do a third shift work fine. Some of my research grant works involves kind of supporting first responders, firefighters, police officers, in how they get sleep around the clock. So paying attention to body cues is going to be important. Strategic napping. So for that third shift, if you're able to get in a nap during your waking period, that's really going to help kind of bolster your sleep schedule. You want to pay attention to lights and caffeine and regularity and try to get as much light as you can toward the beginning of your shift, but not as you're going into sleep, and make your sleep environment as dark and quiet as you can.
Well, that might be hard, too, when you're driving home with the sun glaring in your eyes at the end of your workday.
Right. So that's why we have sort of amber glasses that block that blue light. So for the people driving east home, after a long shift or after, 48 hours at the fire station, that can be a really dangerous situation. A lot of car crashes occur from people driving home from the night shift. You want to not get too stimulated so that you can fall asleep, but be awake enough that you can drive home safely.
Do you find it's difficult for children to get the right amount of sleep every night? What are the obstacles there?
So many obstacles. So under pandemic situation or under normal situations, or both?
Well, you know, even in the pandemic, when everyone is at home, there are new sounds and new stressors.
New sounds, new stressors, and kids pick up on things probably more than we realize. So even little kids are going to come up with new worries and see us being worried and adopt some of that. So I think part of that is I know my four-year-old isn't getting the activity that she's used to. So, you know, we used to go to the playground every night to burn off energy, take, you know, walks and all that situation. And she's not as good at not touching things. So I'm more worried about her going out than I am my bigger kid.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of it. And they're also more anxious.
Roxanne Pritchard is with us, a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of St. Thomas. We're spending the hour on sleep and how the pandemic is throwing it out of whack for some. Do you suffer from insomnia? Has it gotten worse since the pandemic? How many hours of sleep do you get? And do you log your sleep? Take a survey. What keeps you from getting a full night's rest? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to our conversation on sleep with Roxanne Pritchard right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we've been talking about how to get a good night's rest. We've talked about vivid dreams since the pandemic outbreak. NPR's All Things Considered co-host Mary Louise Kelly shared one of hers.
The other night, I broke into my NPR colleague's apartment and stole all her toilet paper. She had dozens and dozens of rolls, so many rolls, stay with me here, so many I then had to steal a beach towel to carry them all, bundled, bulging, slung over my shoulder, Santa Claus style.
Have you had vivid dreams? What are they like? Are you napping more? When do you take those naps and how do they affect your nights? We're at 800-642-1234. Roxanne Pritchard is a neuroscience and psychology professor, and she's studied the sleep patterns of college students for more than a dozen years. Let's take a call now. Jean is with us from Sun Prairie this morning. Hi, Jean.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm always up bright and early, a lot of times much earlier than I want to be. And I have some questions about the association of the gut biome with sleep, and then also about body core temperature and sleep. I understand that core temperature goes down before sleep, but yet it's hard for me to go to sleep with cold hands and feet, and I really like
Do you rely on like a warm bath or a hot shower or something like that?
Yeah, could you talk about when's the best time to take that?
Roxanne, what do you think?
Yeah, your body's temperature is one of the best sort of clues you can give about when you want to go to sleep. Our circadian rhythm is such that our core body temperature drops dramatically as we're getting sleepy. And in the hour before we wake up naturally, it increases. So we can measure this body rhythm schedule with your temperature. So it's best if when we go to sleep, the room is cool, but we are not cold. And that can be a hard thing to get, especially if you have a circulation issue where your hands and feet are cold. So I like to say pile on as many blankets as you'd like, have warm fuzzy slippers, but have the room be cool, and that can help you sleep. For most people, taking a hot shower before bed can help their core body temperature drop because our blood rushes to the skin to cool us off after a hot shower, and that drops our core body temperature, so that can be a way to help get us to sleep. But for some people with circulation issues, that just leaves us hotter for a while. So for some people, taking a hot shower before bed helps. For some people, that doesn't.
What about the gut biome and its relation with sleep? Is there a connection?
Yes, there is, and it's fascinating. This is one of the newer forms of research. that is giving us a lot more information. I'm not prepared to speak much about it, but I do know that we've covered a couple of these articles looking at how people's circadian rhythms of what their gut bacteria are doing are different depending on your morningness, your eveningness. They're also different by BMI category. So there's a lot more to the gut than we know. It does interact with sleep.
So body mass index, body mass index interacts with our rest?
Yes, it does in different ways. So in some ways it can be involved in gut microbiome. In probably more common ways, people with higher BMIs are more susceptible to sleep disordered breathing. So a lot of people who have sleep apnea don't even realize that they have sleep apnea, and that's negatively interfering with their sleep.
And that's when you stop breathing while you're asleep?
Right. I'm going to make a kind of yucky noise, so forgive me. But if you recognize this in yourself or in a bed partner, that's a sign that you could have sleep apnea. So if you're breathing and then those kind of noises, those gasping and stopping and starting again, are indices that your body isn't getting good oxygen during the sleep cycle.
And then that wakes you up so you can take a breath.
That wakes you up, so you have to take a breath. So my husband, who's actually kind of a lean guy, who used to sleep 10 hours a night and still be exhausted, was waking up 42 times an hour to breathe, basically, before he was treated.
Wow. So does he use like a CPAP now?
So he uses a CPAP now, and that has transformed his life for the better. But he wasn't aware that he had a sleep disorder. He had just lived with it probably since childhood.
Oh, my goodness. And so how does a CPAP work, and how can that help people get the air that they need?
So the CPAP is a continuous positive air pressure. So basically it is a mask, and there's different shapes mask for different shaped faces. And it blows kind of room air into your kind of nasal cavity, and that can be enough to keep open your airway. Now, that's not the only treatment for sleep apnea. There can also be dental appliances that work great for some people. And there's other kind of surgeries that can be helpful. I was working with a football player who basically had enormous tonsils and adenoids, and once he had those removed, his sleep was great.
We're talking with Roxanne Pritchard, a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of St. Thomas. She's taking your questions about sleep at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Joe now, calling from Chippewa Falls this morning. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
What's on your mind about sleep?
Not a whole lot. I think like during the pandemic right now, we're talking about anxieties and how this whole thing is affecting our sleep patterns. I think it's also important to, in my opinion, to kind of get rid of the toxic things in our life, social media, some news media outlets as well. I think we just need to relax our minds a little bit more and try to focus on the better things in life, whether it be like yard work or our hobbies, things that make us happy. I know I found out for me, like taking long walks in the evening has really helped my sleep pattern. I suffer from anxiety disorder since 2013. So my sleep is not that great ever. But I noticed I took out a lot of these factors in my life, and my quality of life and sleep has improved. So it's a win-win in those outlets. So
How are you doing now during the pandemic with managing your anxiety disorder? I would imagine those walks are really helping in the evening.
Absolutely. So as I said before, I found that like social media was causing a lot of stress. There's like Facebook and Twitter, just full of people that are angry and they're expressing their opinions in irrational ways, and those things can cause, you know, a lot of different types of triggers for anxiety and stress. Even the news outlets, you know, we're facing times of false information being spread all over the media right now. So it's really hard to believe what's being put out there. And those kind of things, for me, cause a lot of stress. And,
well, Joe, thank you so much for describing your situation. Roxanne, there is a lot of noise that Joe finds on social media and elsewhere online.
Absolutely. And I think he's doing great to limit that and to take evening walks. From sort of a sleep perspective, those walks help you get in touch with the kind of the Earth's natural rhythm, that the light is going down, evening is getting cool. You're moving your body in a way that's helpful and stress relieving. And that can help us settle into sleep. So that's a great approach. And yeah, I've been doing a lot more yard work because it's cathartic. It's got effort-driven reward. It's something that helps you relax and do something productive in ways that you can change. It's also true that looking at that social media, I mentioned earlier in the show that I have to turn all that off literally afternoon, because I'll just, my brain will want to compare and contrast and get angry and problem solve. And none of that is going to help me with my family right now. None of that is going to help me relax and sleep.
And you've even made distinctions for when you can have difficult conversations with your spouse that can't occur after a certain hour.
Right. Yeah, that we learned that only 5 years into our relationship. but he is an evening person. I'm a morning person. He's not ready to talk about hard stuff until at least mid-morning. And I'm done talking about hard stuff after evening, or like early evening. So this is a brief window when we have our best interactions.
What happens for people who are on different medications to manage something like anxiety or another mental health challenge, and that also can interfere with sleep?
And that's definitely challenging to figure out. I'd say, just as a reminder, the best practices all involve some sort of cognitive, behavioral, or emotional approach as well. So the number one treatment for anxiety or for insomnia is cognitive behavioral therapy. Sleep medications just kind of make it worse. So for insomnia, it's got to be something that gives you tools to figure out, what is my body arousal? How does that change my beliefs and attitudes about my sleep? How does that change my behaviors and habits? And so it kind of helps us, give us the tools to, oh, I'm aware that I'm becoming anxious about this. What are my tools to calm down? And how can I make sure I'm doing best practices with sleep?
We're talking with Roxanne Pritchard. She's our guide this hour on sleep during the pandemic, and her research focuses on sleep and circadian rhythms. What keeps you up at night right now? Do you have sleep apnea or use a CPAP machine? Have you changed your treatment plan due to the coronavirus? What are you doing now? Still time to talk about sleep at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back with this with Roxanne Pritchard in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The COVID-19 pandemic has had such a monumental impact on our sleep that researchers, they're now starting to study its effects. We have Roxanne Pritchard with us, a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. She stays with us answering your questions about sleep. Roxanne, your research primarily in the past has focused on studying how college students sleep. What have you found about how students in this age group get rest?
What I found is that most of them don't have an embodied understanding of what it feels like to get good rest. So most of them have started high school far too early and have basically been exhausted since puberty. So when I speak with athletic teams or a large group of students, I say, when's the last time you've gone to bed when you feel sleepy and slept until you're done sleeping every day for a week in a row? And most of them don't have an answer to that question. They literally haven't done that. The students today are exhausted all the time and used to just coping with caffeine, with medications like stimulants to try to kind of just power through. So there's a lot of relearning involved in saying, no, good sleep is possible. Here's how to do it. Many students are capable to do it, capable of doing it, and here's how.
They just need some, you know, some of the mechanics and some of the good habits to start on that on in that process. Haley from Milwaukee called and couldn't stay with us. Haley says they always sleep poorly and bought a smartwatch to help track sleep patterns. Haley says it seems almost helpful. What do you think of sleep apps or phones or smartwatches to help track our sleep?
I think for some people, it's great. If you're using it as a general kind of reminder about schedule regularity, some of my favorite parts about those apps are the ones that remind you of, hey, if you want to get a good 7 hours of sleep tonight and wake up at this time, now is the time to prepare getting ready for bed. So we need more cues in our society to say, hey, now's the time to get ready to go to bed. And that's okay. So start powering down, start relaxing. Those are very helpful. So for some people, tracking their sleep helps them get good sleep. Just like for some people, tracking their food helps them kind of keep a good balanced nutrition. But for some people, that tracking can be anxiety provoking.
I just found one of my old smart watches that had very limited features, but I hooked it into the computer and found that it had tracked my sleep during 2014 in the early months when my twins were newborns. And it was fascinating to look back at that data, but it just made me realize that data is around on those smartwatches and they can be for a long time.
Right. And who owns that data? What do they do with that data? Those are big questions that kind of involve people's privacy.
Corey from Madison called, couldn't stay with us. Corey says they sleep about 7 to 8 hours a night. They have two naps a day, sleep hard at night, but still feel tired all the time. And Corey isn't sure what's going on. What might Corey check out? What would you suggest?
I would suggest working with maybe a primary care physician as well, or primary care provider, as well as a sleep health professional. There's probably something going on. It could be so many different things. It could be hormonal. It could be anxiety and depression can also change our sleep profile like that. It could be a circadian rhythm disruption. But something is not quite right with the sleep.
You have to do some sleuthing, though, and really starting with your primary care physician might be a start there.
Might be a start just to kind of rule out other things. And then I would want to know more about kind of what is the experience of sleep like? Could there be snoring or gasping during sleep?
First responders and police officers, as you were saying earlier, can work those erratic schedules. What should we understand about their sleep wellness?
We should understand that they're incredibly hardworking and many are working against the body's natural tendency or in time for best sleep. So I would say probably the most important thing is to have the supervisors in those roles talk with somebody who is capable of providing best practices in shift work. So there's better and worse ways to do rotating schedules, for example, and to make sure that the supervisors of first responders understand, like, yes, naps are going to be really important. How can we ensure that those can happen safely? How can we give the tools that the first responders need to get sleep disorders recognized and treated? Can we, you know, give out blue light blocking glasses for people on their drives home? I would say the most important thing is to work with somebody who can provide that good sleep hygiene and sleep health assessment to support the health of first responders.
Roxanne, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Roxanne Pritchard is a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of St. Thomas, and her research focuses on sleep and circadian rhythms. Milwaukee's communities of color have been hit particularly hard by the pandemic. In March, Governor Evers called African-American deaths in the city a crisis within a crisis. And since then, nearly half of the coronavirus cases and deaths in Milwaukee have been minorities. Corrine Hess has more.
It started as a fever in mid-March. And then Lawrence Riley had trouble catching his breath. His daughter, Whitley, says Riley's fever broke, then he got worse.
My mama had to get him dressed. He just wasn't his normal self.
On March 16th, the 66-year-old Navy veteran and former Milwaukee firefighter was taken to the hospital. 3 days later, Riley was the first person in Milwaukee County to die from complications of coronavirus. Whitley says her dad had chronic inflammatory lung disease, known as COPD. But before he tested positive for the virus, her family didn't realize COVID-19 had reached Milwaukee.
We knew that the virus had hit America, but we didn't think that, you know, it had hit Wisconsin or Milwaukee. So when they took him in and, like, tested him right away, that was just a shock.
As of May 11th, there have been more than 4,000 cases of coronavirus in Milwaukee County and 219 deaths. African Americans represent about a quarter of the county's population, but account for almost half of the deaths. Of the 219 coronavirus-related deaths, 108 of the victims were Black, including Riley. Racial disparities in health outcomes, including childhood lead poisoning, infant mortality, and obesity, have plagued Milwaukee for years. So much so that in 2019, Milwaukee County declared racism to be a public health crisis. Dr. Ben Weston heads emergency medicine for Milwaukee County. He says the COVID-19 outbreak makes the disparities more obvious.
We can see that an African-American person is nearly three times more likely to die of COVID-19 in Milwaukee County than a white person. And they're a staggering seven times more likely to die of COVID than a white person in the state of Wisconsin.
Milwaukee was one of the first cities in the country to break down coronavirus data by race. As more cities have done so, national data shows counties with more African-American residents have more coronavirus cases. Melanie McCurtis is a community organizer in Metcalf Park. The neighborhood is 98% African-American, and 76% of the residents there are renters. The neighborhood is also one of the city's coronavirus hotspots. Despite the risk, McCurtis says when you're poor, coronavirus isn't a priority.
Top worry is food, and then it's COVID-19, it's rent, it's a medley of things. I mean, our families are concerned about all of these things at one time.
The food pantry in Metcalf Park is only open 3 hours a week, so food is scarce and social distancing is impossible. McCurtis has been delivering care packages every other week. She says people are inside their homes, but the community is still at risk.
I'm at risk from COVID-19 because I'm poor. I'm at risk of getting this virus, and because I still have to go and work this job, or I still have to go and get food, and I still might have to travel on the bus.
Recently, Milwaukee's Hispanic community has also seen a greater increase in COVID-19 cases. Weston says COVID-19 is spreading quickly in communities of color because of decades-long disparities. Whether this will lead to meaningful change by ways of safer homes, fresher food, and easier access to health care after the pandemic remains to be seen. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.